Good morning. I will call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 13th, 2025. And we have a light schedule before us today, but I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Freiberg, have you had a chance to peruse the minutes?
Yes, they were inspiring. I would like to move approval.
I, too, felt that they made my heart soar like a hawk. So Representative Freiberg moves the minutes for March 11th, 2025. All in favor? Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are approved. Okay. Today, first on our agenda, because we were not able to get them in the last time, appreciate your accommodation, we have the Minnesota Historical Society overview. So if you would, both introduce yourself for the records and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nash. My name is Kent Whitworth. I serve as the Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society.
David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society, Government Relations, Public Policy.
Thank you for being here this morning. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Nash, and soon to be Chair Cleavorn. We appreciate the opportunity to spend a few minutes providing a very high-level overview of the Minnesota Historical Society, and then to conclude with our specific budget request. We also look forward to ongoing conversations in the coming days with members of the committee, and we look forward to the possibility of the committee visiting the History Center for a behind-the-scenes tour. I know a few of you have done that, and we look forward to sharing that experience with all of you as schedules allow. So thank you very much. We'll move right along. Just a little bit of background about MNHS, and you've got this presentation before you, so I will not read all of the bullet points, but I want to point out a few things. That today we are governed by an executive council of about 30 members, we also have very specific responsibilities outlined in state statute, Chapter 138. To say a little bit about why history matters, and I know a number of you are shall I say, fans or believers in the value of history, but would like to just touch on a couple of things. When we think about this, we think about the legacy that we inherited from generations of Minnesotans that stewarded our history, and it's incumbent on us to steward while it's on our watch and so that we can hand off to future generations. And we think about whether that's preserving physical artifacts, capturing stories, written or oral, and other ways that we preserve and share history. I did mention there are specific functions outlined in Chapter 138. Just to name a few, the Minnesota Historical Society is the manager, the keeper of the state archives, and then we also manage the Historic Sites Network, just to name a few. I'd also be remiss if I didn't mention that history and heritage are significant parts of the Minnesota state economy, and studies have repeatedly shown that heritage tourists tend to stay longer and therefore spend more money. So it's a wise audience to invest in. So how do we do this work? We are guided by the mission statement of the Minnesota Historical Society, and there are several key words from our standpoint. Perhaps the most important is all. I also believe that curiosity is a key for us to engage Minnesotans. And the outcomes that we hope to achieve are a more inclusive, empathetic, and certainly informed society. At the end of the day, we're about building understanding and building a sense of community. I won't say much about our strategic imperatives, but we are about 3.5 years into a strategic plan that we are deeply committed to. You see those concepts. I will come back to the concept of sustainability as we talk about our budget request, but there are slides in the packet that outline how we define those imperatives that guide our work. And then I'd like to conclude my portion for now of this presentation by posing a question. Simply, how do you learn history? And I think about my way of connecting to history, and I'm a visual learner in many respects, so I find myself gravitating to an exhibit experience. Many people prefer maybe a speaker. Others want to read about it in a textbook. You see Northern Lights up there, and I think we've got a hard copy here. happy to make copies on loan to all of you if you'd like to see that textbook. We have the Minnesota Historical Society Press and publish a number of titles each year. And I think most all of us learn history by experiencing going to historic places, and you see images of Jeffers Petroglyph and Split Rock Lighthouse, just to name two of our 26 historic sites that are open to the public. So the point in all of this, Chair and members of the committee, is MNHS strives to meet Minnesotans where they are in their own journey with their personal and community and state history, and that's why we offer a wide variety of ways for Minnesotans, frankly, of all ages, to learn about our shared past. So with that, I'll hand off to David.
Mr. Kelleher, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. As Kent described, there are many ways to learn about history, and this slide shows many of the ways that we deliver history to Minnesotans. We are a statewide organization, and we strive to reach every corner of the state through historic sites, exhibits, education, and we'll come back to education in a moment. We have a library at the History Center where Minnesotans can access collections, and we outreach to local history organizations to help them do their work better. Mr. Chair, as mentioned, we publish Northern Lights, which is the curriculum for sixth graders. Mr. Chair, you're familiar with the digital edition of this. This is the paper edition, and I'll pass a copy around.
Actually, if we could get a page maybe to come up and grab that. Thank you so much. And as Mr. Kelleher said, that you can actually, members, if you wish, to a temporary copy can be delivered to your office. It's really worth the read.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The slide on the screen right now shows the school districts where Northern Lights is in use. The social studies standards have Minnesota Studies at the sixth grade level, and this textbook and the curriculum that goes with it pulls in economics, history, civics, and is taught at the sixth grade level. We support teachers who are using Northern Lights by teacher training, and lots of outreach to make sure they can be effective in their use. Wanted to spend just a quick moment on historic sites. As Kent mentioned, historic sites are outlined in Minnesota statutes in 138. Historic sites are our statewide presence, where it happened, in locations that represent some of Minnesota's most significant historic places. We're responsible for 26 sites open to the public, 150 structures, and half of those are over 100 years old. So they represent some specific challenges that we reach on the capital budget side of things, but we keep those places in good shape for visitors across the state. And as Kent mentioned, we are certainly a part of the tourism economy. People want to have interesting things to do when they travel around the state. Another important aspect of our work is collections, and I really hope that you're able to come over to visit us at the History Center and catch a bit of behind the scenes. You drive by the building on your way in here every morning and wonder what's behind those big walls. There's a lot of fun stuff there. So a quick glimpse of the storage areas and the conservation laboratories. You can see the types of things that we have: photos, works of art, publications, objects. One of the things we're really proud of is we're in the process of digitizing the state's newspapers. We have virtually every newspaper published in Minnesota on microfilm, and if you've gone through those, it's a little bit tedious, but as we digitize those, you can do a word search, and your research is that much more efficient. It's pretty amazing. It's going to take us years to do that, and we're melting that iceberg a little bit at a time. We serve lots of Minnesotans, approximately 850,000 visitors to our in-person visits to our historic sites and museums, including school kids, and lots of visits to our website. We have about 19,000 participants in History Day, which is a national competition where students choose a subject within a common national theme and they can do research and present their findings at a variety of media exhibits or papers or performances or websites. We have many award winners from Minnesota when we go to nationals, and I think it's safe to say we're punching above our weight in terms of History Day performance nationally. We have 19,000 members, people who choose to become a member of the Minnesota Historical Society to support the work that we do and have a way to get into historic sites across the state. And we also have the human resources, whether it's volunteers who really make this happen, or our staff. We have approximately 400 full-time equivalents across the state at historic sites. Some of these folks are seasonal employees, and many are full-time, work here in St. Paul at the History Center, but 400 full-time equivalents. Mr. Chair, turning to budget, this pair of pie charts gives you a snapshot of where the money comes from and where it goes to. The blue piece of pie that says 35%, that's our state operating budget supported by the general fund appropriations that this committee and others make happen. That is an important foundation for the work that we do. In addition to that, we bring resources to the table through earned revenue and donations from individuals like members who want to support our work. So we appreciate the support that is the foundation of the work that we do, but we are leveraging that to deliver a better history product to more people across the state. And you can see where the money goes to. A large chunk of it goes to historic sites and heritage preservation, as well as education functions. Another way to look at how we spend these dollars is that a large chunk of it is in staffing. This pie chart shows that just about half is staffing when you take out grants that go to local history organizations. That total becomes a little bit larger. Nevertheless, staffing is a really important part of our overall budget and our operations.
So, Mr.
One more, Kent. So, Mr. Chair, our operating budget is supported by the base budget, $23.9 million each year from the general fund. And again, this is staffing, operational costs, and supplemented by earned revenue.
And now, Mr. Chair, the request before you, building on that baseline budget of $23.9 million, is an operating adjustment for the biennium of $925,000, a little less than the first year of the biennium, and then it grows in that second year. As you see below there, we've got a few emerging challenges, some needs and opportunities. We continue to work our way back to pre-pandemic numbers. You see that from a couple of slides that we have come back well, but we are not up to that pre-pandemic mark. And so that's our goal, to continue to build that out in terms of in-person visitation, as well as virtual service and impact. We've got a sustainability challenge like other entities within state government and in the nonprofit and frankly for-profit sector, where we need to make sure that that our infrastructure to support our mission delivery is adequate. So that's why a sustainable future is our fourth strategic imperative, and we have been working on that quite a bit the last 3.5 years. We need to make sure that our financial and human resources adequately support the mission delivery. And frankly, we have increasing costs like everybody else. Many of those are fixed costs regarding utilities, rent, those kinds of things. We are growing our revenue at a healthy rate, but it's not keeping up with expenses. And so, as you have heard from others that have sat on these chairs and testified before this committee, the operating adjustment that is proposed here will not be enough to keep up with the increased cost of staff compensation. David referenced utilities and then History Center building costs and other expenses. So we just wanted to be candid about that. And we have talked to you before, even in this session, about the efforts that we are taking to plan to make sure that we are being fiscally responsible and that we are adjusting to the financial realities that not only we face, but certainly the state of Minnesota faces. So as we conclude, I just want to thank you for the support of this committee, for enabling this wide-ranging work of the Minnesota Historical Society. We are grateful for the support of the people of Minnesota through the legislature, and we respectfully request your support for at least this operating request before you this morning.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for the presentation. I won't speak for Lee Cleborne, but as we put budgets together, we'll be looking at everything, and it'll be a very interesting puzzle as we get to the finish line. But know that I appreciate the work that you do, and my family has enjoyed the time that we've gone through, and I still need to get down to what would be my favorite part of the archives, which is the historic map collection. But nerd fest for me as a trained cartographer. But it would be a lot of fun for us to take a field trip. I think Mr. Grunhauser has been working to find a time for everybody to spend a little bit of time over there. So with that, without any member comments, we will thank you very much for being here this morning. And we know that we'll be talking with you again.
Great.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we move on to House File 1234, I'll just take a brief moment. We are joined by the high school pages. My daughter Emily was a page last week, thoroughly enjoyed it, and is still talking about it. So maybe if you all would stand up, and we will welcome you to committee. I hope that you have as good a time as my daughter did. As I said, she's still talking about it. So you have a great week, and you have a great day ahead of you on the floor. So thanks for being here. Okay, next on the agenda, Representative Scott has House File 1234. I feel like it's Sesame Street Day. We'll do some counting and colors later. And because you're not a member of the committee, Representative Scott, I will move House File 1234 to come before the committee. Our intent is to lay this bill over. And I believe, Representative Scott, you have an A1 amendment. And I will move the A1 for you to come before the committee.
Thank you, Please Mr. Proceed. Chair. We are not going to offer the A1 today.
Okay.
It was fairly technical in nature, but in making those changes, I think it caused more, not consternation, but concern, shall we say. So we will continue to work with stakeholders, and we'll just go forward with what the bill is in front of us, Mr. Chair.
Okay, if Chair that's withdraws okay. the A1. Please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's wonderful to be before your committee. I don't know that I've been before. I've never been before you, Mr. Chair, so that's...
Bring snacks?
It's an honor to be here. Hopefully that'll cover it. this bill is focused on increasing transparency in public construction projects. This bill ensures that small businesses working on these projects receive timely updates on the payments made by public owners. This provides predictability and fairness in the payment process. Earlier this week, we met with a group of public owners, and I am committed to continuing collaboration with those folks. In fact, when I got here this morning, several of the stakeholders are having a conversation about possible solutions to this problem. And I said, I'm looking for a way to come up with an app, a million-dollar idea so I can retire that will solve this problem. However, we must also ensure that businesses working on public projects are made in a timely and transparent manner. House File 1234 aims to provide clarity on the payment process, allowing contractors and subcontractors to plan their finances accordingly. In your package, you have a one-pager about the bill and a list of 16 associations that are in support of this bill. And I have two testifiers with me this morning. To share their experience and perspectives.
Okay. Who is intending? Okay, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is John Lloyd. I'm the Vice President of Lloyd's Construction Services in Shakopee, Minnesota. Good morning, Mr. Chair and respected committee members. We are a third-generation family business in the construction industry. Both of our daughters and their husbands are active in our business with the goal of continuing a family business legacy. We take great pride in our involvement in public projects, and we truly value our trade partners and public owners we perform the work for. Participating in the public work comes with significant administrative responsibilities and long payment times. To work on these projects, we secure specific insurance and bonds. We provide certified payroll showing every employee that provided labor to the project with Social Security information included every 2 weeks. For many of the projects, we perform background checks, and some go as far as fingerprints for each employee on the job. Most of the time, this is just the beginning. In my hand, I have an example of a project that was completed for Met Council. This project was about 1,585 hours of our workforce on site. The billable amount was about $200,000. This is 276 pages of documentation that we provided per the contract to the general contractor and the Met Council. Our last day on site was November 25th, 2024. We are still owed an undisputed amount of $8,417.83. To some, that may sound like a small amount. This is our profit if we're lucky. We comply with all the requirements, yet we lack a simple, timely notification when payments are made. The concept is as easy as the bill number, HF1234. It proposes a straightforward solution requiring an email or any notification, really, from a public owner informing the subs when payment has been made to the general contractor or prime. A few of the agencies have expressed that subs can just reach out by phone with questions or concerns. I would challenge anybody to try that and find a live human being with answers. If HF1234 is passed, it would allow us to plan cash flow and know when we should be getting paid. When you look at this 276-page document packet and think that every other trade on the project submitted the same documents, it does not seem like much of an ask for agencies to provide a single update monthly on payment. Transparency is a good thing, especially when on publicly funded projects. We believe that this would also promote and solidify true trade partners and collaboration that need to happen for a successful project. We hope you will pass HF1234 and provide transparency on payments of public construction projects. This is very important to the subcontracting community, but I'm trying to stay brief because we respect your time. I'm open to questions now and in the future, and I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lloyd. If you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Aaron Dean. I am a construction lawyer for more than 25 years and have the gray hair to prove it. I don't get to see any of the good projects that go well. I see all of the bad projects, particularly payment disputes. And this House File 1234 is designed to reduce litigation and reduce my workload and the workload of other construction lawyers. And it really promotes transparency, and we need your help. I want to just thank Representative Scott and the bipartisan co-authors of this bill. It's a very important bill. House File 1234 is designed to increase transparency on public construction projects. And it also will have the added effect of improving collaboration with public owners and all stakeholders. And it will accelerate payment to small businesses here in Minnesota. Really, this bill accomplishes its goals in two different ways, and I want to talk about both. First, payment notifications to subcontractors will occur. On line 3.3 of the bill, public owners are required to notify subs when a payment is made to the general contractor. And that becomes important because under the prompt payment statute, general contractors are required to pay a subcontractor for the work that they have received payment for within 10 days. And the problem is Mr. Lloyd and his company and every other subcontractor, they don't know when the payment is actually made. We will work with every public owner to find the language that they want and compromises they want to meet their needs. But I think it's really easy how to accomplish this, and it already exists. Number one, you can just have a contract obligation that the public owner requires the general contractor to notify all the subs when they've been paid. Check the box. Number two, all of the public owners use something called Procore with the general contractors, and think of Procore as like an electronic library. All they have to do is post the pay application to Procore and then post the fact that the payment was made, and then everyone gets to see it. It's not any work for anyone. The third way to do it is there's a weekly AOC meeting, architect, owner, contractor. And at that meeting, all of the subcontractors receive the meeting minutes. Another way to accomplish this is at the AOC meeting and the meeting minutes, just verify whether payment was issued and how much. And that way the subcontractors all know on a weekly basis what is happening. I don't think it's all that hard to accomplish this, but we want to make sure that all public owners are heard and that we hear their concerns. We have zero intention of making this hard, difficult, or creating any extra work for public owners. That is not our goal at all. Second thing that this House File 1234 bill will accomplish is you can see on line 2.29 of the bill. That's pretty important. It will disallow contract procedures, particularly the use of electronic platforms, that prevents a subcontractor from invoicing for their work. Currently, subcontractors are forced to pay for this electronic platform, and then they're not allowed to bill for their completed work. It's absurd. And we need your help to bar that type of contract provision. You know, this is not a situation where public owners are on the different side of the fence of subcontractors. They want to see subcontractors get paid. Subcontractors want to get paid. You know who's going to be harmed by this bill? Construction lawyers. And if there's anyone to harm by this body, it's to prevent litigation from occurring. So I hope that you'll go forward and allow this bill to proceed. I'm available to answer any and all questions. I've got 26 years of lawsuit experience. I only see the bad jobs, and I've got the gray hair to prove it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Next, we have Wayne Wozlowski and Tori Key. If you could both make your way to the testifier's table. Mr. Wozlowski, thank you for coming back to the committee. You were just here. Please proceed. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Wayne Wozlowski, Assistant Commissioner at Department of Administration. And I'll be very brief, and first just want to say thank you to the subcontractors and Representative Scott on the discussions to date. I think, as was pointed out in the testimony, we have shared goals here. We need subcontractors to be successful on our public jobs. We need them to want to work on public jobs. We all know the cost pressures that are out there in the market. And we need as many subcontractors interested in working on our projects as possible. I think we're into the discussions on the very specifics of the how this happens and who gets the notification. And that's where we see that there is some cost impacts here with how the language is currently written. We think between our payment system, there's currently not an automatic notification system as part of that. So there's no way that once a payment is issued, there's automatically email goes out to a set distribution list. And it really is getting down to the house part of this. How do we actually do the notification? We already in meeting minutes, and this is just for, and I should mention, this is across hundreds of projects with multiple tiers of subs. Sometimes you can have three or four or five different tiers of subs, and the owner doesn't have complete visibility into all those tiers and contacts. So we're really down to the question of making sure the how, the mechanism, and the who on who actually receives the notification. The goals behind the legislation on making sure It's in statutory requirement for prompt payment, both for as a public owner side of it, and then within our contracts and within statutes on after the prime receives their payments on getting subcontractors paid on a timely basis. So with that, we look forward to continued discussions with all the stakeholders here. And again, we value our subcontractors and that partnership, and we want to make sure that we're finding a solution that's workable for everyone. So thank you, Stan, for any questions if there are any.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Ms. Key, if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair Nash and members. My name is Tori Key. I am from the League of Minnesota Cities, representing 841 member cities across the state. We're sorry to hear of the complications that are being faced by subcontractors in obtaining their payments, but I'm here to just address a couple concerns with the notification requirements that are on in Section 2 on page 3. And currently, the main issue is that with city contracts for construction, they do not require a prime contractor to disclose the name of subcontractors to the municipality. So requiring this is how it is outlined here in the bill could be a complication if contractors do not provide updated information of their subcontractors. If there's large projects might have a number of tiers of subcontractors, I think, as we've already addressed, and those could sometimes change if they need to, they're not performing or their portion is done, or a need arises that requires a new subcontractor. It would be helpful if there was a mechanism in that section that requires a contractor to disclose in a timely manner to a municipality if a subcontractor has changed, and to provide them with all the contact information. Otherwise, cities face unintended non-compliance with the section of the bill as written without that information from the prime contractors. Secondly, there's been a lot of conversation about transparency and timely payments, and I just want to do a brief outline of what a city's process is to make payment. It is all outlined in Chapter 412 for statutory cities. Obviously, there's also the timely payment statute in 471 as well. But progress payments for these contracts are made throughout the process, and that's outlined either in the contract or in statute. I do have a copy of our procedures for paying city claims, if that's helpful to anyone. It outlines that as well. But those progress payments, those invoices are made to the city. The city clerk or administrator or manager then must process that invoice and present it to the council. That's typically done at a council meeting. And those meetings occur on a pretty regular basis, you know, between 1 and 4 times a month for most cities. Those are publicly noticed meetings and open to the public, and they can come and hear those invoices that have been submitted to the city for payment. Once council reviews that, which is generally needed unless there is there's an exception for the exact amount of a claim has been fixed by a judgment, previously approved contract, or state law, those don't need ongoing approval, but the city administration would still present that information to the city council at their regular meetings that those invoices had come through, even if they do not require council approval for payment at that exact time. And then once those payments are made, the city is statutorily required, as we know, under 271, to make that prompt payment, including that language of the penalty if a prime contractor fails to pay the subcontractor within 10 days. So once paid, those claims are then logged into the city's claims register, and that's also public information. So understand that this information might not be coming out in an email or in a push way every time a payment is made, but there is a pretty standard process that cities follow when making payments of claims. And so we hope that by explaining this process, pointing us to some resources, and engaging in these conversations, we can come to a solution that's mutually beneficial for all groups involved. Because as some of the testifiers said, we don't want to see subcontractors not getting paid either, but we just want to make sure that the notification requirement works for everyone involved. So I appreciate being here in front of you all. I appreciate the authors for this bill and looking forward to working with all the stakeholders. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Key. Members, after the deadline to sign up for testifiers passed, we did have somebody request to come onto the list, and that would be John Kudrowski from the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Mr. Kudrowski, we could afford you maybe 2 minutes or so. Brevity is always appreciated. So if you, as you make your way to the testifier table, once you get there, if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is John Kudrowski. I'm with the Metropolitan Airports Commission, or the MAC. MAC owns and operates the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and our 6 general aviation airports in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. We value our partnerships with the general contractors and the subcontractors working at the airport. They help and improve our facilities and our infrastructure. They also provide, they also help us in achieving our award-winning status as an airport and monitoring and keeping up the infrastructure. The MAC also recognizes the importance of the prompt payments through a project, and we work closely with our general contractors to ensure that the subcontractors are met and they're also timely paid. In fact, MAC includes several statutory provisions in our contracts, including those prompt payment requirements, the payment performance bonds, interest for the late payments and attorney's fees for the prevailing civil action brought on by the subcontractors, and also those prevailing wage requirements. We also have a large infrastructure that takes place, and it takes quite a bit of individuals to do that. We currently have approximately about 174 active construction projects with an approximate total value of about $1.24 billion. We make weekly payments to general contractors, especially those who submit our payment applications, often averaging over 20 payments per week, including up to about $5 to $8 million per week in payments. We refrain from getting involved generally between the general contractor and the subcontractor. We have certain contract provisions that are made applicable through those contracts. The MAC doesn't approve and review each and every subcontract. We receive a small number of inquiries from subcontractors per year about delays in payments. Most of them are related to either disputed work or mistakes on the required payment or on the required paperwork submitted by the general contractors. When the MAC receives these payment inquiries, we will share the payment status information, pay applications, the process, and assist with corrective mechanisms that the subcontractor has available to them, such as providing the paperwork on the payment bonds. As introduced, the bill would require the MAC to notify every tier of subcontractor of every payment on a construction project. The MAC's construction projects can be complex, and it is common to have subcontractors for the subcontractors, sometimes up to 6 companies removed from the MAC contract. It's also typical that large construction contracts can have over 50 subcontractors working through multi-year projects. The MAC does not always have a full list of every subcontractor in every tier on the project, and there are times when there are changes in the subcontractors. The bill will require an administrative process to be established to collect all this information. I'll conclude that MAC wants to ensure our workers, both general and subcontractors, are receiving prompt payment. We agree with the value of the transparency for all steps in this process. However, we still have questions and concerns about the bill, and we look forward to working with Representative Scott and all the stakeholders to ensure that the bill leads to the visibility the contractors want without creating a more complex and confusing process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kudrowski. We will now move on to member questions. Representative Joy, you had a question.
Kind of a overall, you know, dealing with subcontractors and being a mayor of a small town, we had an airport, and of course, with one of my businesses, we do contracting ourselves. So we're that subcontractor waiting for payment. I think this bill has great intent. This is great, Peggy, what you're doing here. I think we need to, Representative Scott, we need to, I think, get more of the players at the table and figure out who's having the issues and who's not. You know, because, like, again, city council, we have a meeting. We approve a payment. It's open to the public. You know, for me, where I came from, a small city, we could have the whole list of contractors on an email, send it out, and everybody could know. But I think this is a good start. I don't think we have to create a big program to do this, but I think we should have all players on the ground to figure out, you know, if it's this Met Council or if it's the state that's seems to be the one that's not doing, or who it is, you know, if it's the cities or if it's bigger cities, smaller cities. So I appreciate this bill, but I think we should get all players in the ground and if you know, I look forward to helping you with the bill too, but yeah, thank you very much.
Representative Scott, any follow-up to that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Joy. I think we have a pretty good coalition of folks at the table right now. We'll continue working. I think everyone in this room that has a concern for this issue wants to solve it and wants to make sure everyone's paid in a timely way. No one should wait for a year. Or in one of the conversations we were having, there was a sub that waited 4 years to be paid. And a lot of these subs are smaller. They can't carry that. So there has to be a solution here. And, you know, we have 16 different entities, associations that are recognizing that this is an issue for them. And so while it may feel small and isolated to some of the primes or some of the agencies or the public actors, it's significant enough to have brought a bill and for 16 different associations to recognize it as a problem. Thank you.
Representative Joy, anything further?
No, I just, like I said, I look forward to, you know, working with Representative Scott on the site. Like I said, it's a good thing. And again, it's given the small, you know, there's primes and then there's small contractors. And the small contractors, like they say, there's some general contractors out there that have weekly meetings. You know, when we did an airport in Sioux Falls, we did some washes down there. Every week we attended meetings down there. And you know, we could have opportunities to ask questions and they were good about it. But, if you know, we just need to figure out, filter through of where this is getting missed and how we can fix it. Thank you.
Representative Quam, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I like that you're trying to, you know, fix some of the loopholes. In your further work, maybe you want to contact the claims committee. There's a bicameral committee, claims of where they've exhausted the legal avenues, because I think there are other loopholes that are popped up. There was one I remember that a general contractor received contracts because of special status and didn't pay the subcontractors. She returned to sovereign land, and there was no legal recourse for the subcontractors to be paid. So that's probably something that come up farther on, but there are odd things that come to the claims court that are the loopholes or gaps in our statutes. I commend your bill and hope that you continue to work on closing those loopholes. Thank you.
Representative Scott, anything on that?
Nope.
Okay, moving on. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. I have a couple questions and a little feedback. I will say I also love the intent of this bill, actually. Nerdy fact, but most folks don't know that I spent a good chunk of my career as a project manager, more in the IT space, but so I actually appreciate a lot of what you're trying to do here, particularly the elements around transparency and the timeliness of getting small businesses paid, where payroll is a real issue, particularly if they have employees. Making sure that they can pay their own bills is really, really important. I know we have several business owners in my family who would be very impacted, so I really appreciate those elements. So there's a couple very brief questions. One, do we have any understanding of, like, sort of what the prevalence or the scope of this is? Like, how often are we finding that the subcontractors are not getting paid in a timely fashion? I'm just curious. Maybe it looks like the testifier maybe is.
Representative Scott or Mr. Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll see if Mr. Dean can answer that question.
Mr. Dean.
He sees it every day, I'm sure.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thanks again for hearing me out. Payment problems exist on every public construction project through no fault of the public owners. And the subcontractors are the last to know. This bill prevents disputes. I would just use an old phrase as you think about how to proceed. Don't let perfect ruin the very good. This is a very, very good bill. It accomplishes what needs to be done for transparency. It may not be perfect. We will try to make it perfect, but in the strive for becoming perfect, let's not have an excuse to do nothing. We need this bill. The only one who gets hurt by this bill passing is me and other construction lawyers, because there'll be fewer lawsuits. I think everyone wins.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. I'm not sure if I totally got an answer to my question, but I appreciate that. The other question is, and this is a little bit more weedsy, so if we need to take some of this offline, that's fine. I appreciate that. I was looking through specifically the requirements for the notification, and I understand that we have currently a system that maybe captures some of this data already. So it might be just pulling some of the fields from that system to put together the notification. But I'm curious how much of the of these elements here on 3.7 through, let's see, 3.24, how much of this is already existing in the system, and how much of this would need to be added?
Representative Scott or Mr. Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. No new information will need to be created. If you provide a copy of the general contractor's pay application, it typically will be in a format published by the American Institute of Architects or the Engineers Joint Council Documents Committee. Those form pay applications will contain a schedule of values that will identify the amount sought, the percentage of completion for each scope of work, the amount of payment for each scope of work. It's very easily traceable by every single subcontractor, and it is what the general contractor has to submit to the owner. It is what the owner and its design team, whether it's an architect or an engineer or in-house staff, review and approve. No one will have to do any extra work. All of the options that I outlined in my initial testimony cost zero to the public owner. By putting in a contract term that requires notification, by publishing the pay applications, which are already public information, on Procore, or submitting them on the weekly AOC, architect, owner, contractor meetings, there's no cost. How oftentimes can you solve a problem at zero cost? And that's what Representative Scott's bill does.
Representative Bonner, last.
Thank you. Yes. So I appreciate, so what I'm hearing, if I understand correctly, is that most of the items in this section actually do, are these data fields already exist in the system, if I heard you correctly. And if that's accurate, what I'm assuming is, in order to make this notification possible, the system would have to be able to have some, generate some sort of report or notification system, which probably would, just to be clear, probably cost money in order to develop that report. Even if it's already existing fields, there's still somebody that has to program it to pull the information out of the system in order to make a notification, right? So I don't know if that's been considered in the bill or what that would cost. It may not cost a lot. It depends. And that's part of the reason for my last question is, if the data already exists, then it's maybe just creating some sort of report, which maybe wouldn't be as labor intensive or as costly. So there's that. So I just want to be clear, though, if you do need to pull all this data out of a system for a notification, it will cost some money. There's a developer that's going to have to write the report. They're going to have to write the code to do that, all of that kind of thing. So I just wanted to check in on, like, whether or not we've thought through what that cost would be, or, you know, how that works. I will also tell you, just as a thing, that I did notice one of the items that relates to scope here talks about the percent complete. I just want to also be clear that the percent complete is a little bit of a subjective measure. What we're really usually measuring is time. So, like, let's say we say this phase two of this plumbing project is scheduled to go 4 weeks, and we're 2 weeks in, we might say it's 50% complete. But that doesn't necessarily relate to the amount of effort that's been completed, more the measure of time. So that's a little bit of a subjective term to have in here. I'm not sure how useful that might be to someone looking at this notification, but just for point of reference. I guess that's all I have, Mr. Chair. But I would say I would love to hear more about how we plan to pull this into a report and what that would cost. But I like the direction of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And I'll just remind all of us it's being laid over to continue the work, so you can work with Representative Scott as that goes along. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for bringing this forward. I think it's really good, a good problem to be working on and to be solving. I also want to actually echo some of what Representative Joy said, just making sure that we have all the stakeholders at the table. It sounds like you're generally doing that, so just want to commend you for that work. And I just want to particularly highlight one of the things that the representative from the League of Minnesota Cities talked about requiring contractors to provide that subcontractor for information. And so basically so that they can then create those notifications. So just wanted to point that out and kind of ask, is that something you'd be willing to consider in your bill?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, they're part of the negotiations, and we'll continue to try to navigate this to find a solution that settles well with everybody.
Very good. Representative Howard, briefly.
Just quickly, thank you, Representative Scott. I agree with Representative Jones that this clearly is a problem, and it seems like a solution is definitely within reach. And the comment about not making perfect the enemy of the good, I think, is really relevant here. And so just wanted to commend you for that and the work that's going on to move the bill forward. My one question is, this is focused on sort of public projects. Do some of the similar billing challenges, et cetera, show up in private projects that don't involve state government? I'm just curious if sort of what we're trying to solve here is isolated to public projects or what you'd say about the difference between a public and a fully private.
Mr. Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is far worse on private construction projects. It is very difficult to get paid, and that's why we have other statutory remedies such as mechanics liens, which then gets the owner involved and the lenders involved. Can't solve every problem in one bill. This bill solves two big problems, and we hope that it proceeds.
Very good. Lead Cleavorn to close for your side.
Thank you, and Representative Scott, Chair Scott, I think this is a really great intent. I commend you and Representative Hollins for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a great bill. I have two concerns, right? And you've addressed the big one of how is this actually really going to be implemented, right? And that I appreciate your continued work on that. One, I think this is actually a business model, right? It's not just the slow payment, but it's when large contractors can hold money for multiple days, they actually make money on the float, right? And that's why it's done. So it is part of the construction business model. The more you can delay, the more money you make on your own, and it increases your margin. So that leads me to my second part, right? So we are allowing, in some way, for the contractors to get off the hook of paying for the deliberate business model that they have by making agencies do the hard work. So I'm just wondering if we should be flipping this on its head and making the contractors responsible for putting together this system, right? So it's just a comment. You don't have to address it today, but it's something I think we need to look at, because especially when you're in hundreds of million dollar projects, right? It's something that we should be looking at. And whether it's at the private sector side or the public sector, if this is really intentional, then we need to address that issue as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Cleavorn. I will say, as a person who represents a lot of small businesses that are subcontractors, this is a huge problem. And, you know, many of them, in order to make payroll, have to take or borrow against receivables. And it becomes very problematic for them after a while. It's just, if, particularly when the payment horizon is months or years out. So I would commend you, Chair Scott, and your bipartisan authors, to your concluding statement, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the good discussion today. Thank you for everyone that came to testify and is at the table working on this. And I think there's, you know, there's going to be some weaving that has to happen with this. I think there may be some possibilities within those software systems that the contractors have where we can work out to Representative Bonner's point. It's probably going to take some programming, but, you know, there's several different issues that we're working through. And so we want to continue to do that. And I appreciate everyone coming to the table to try to solve this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And with that, House File 1234 is laid over. Okay, we will now move on to House File 1956. And Chair Anderson, since you're a member of the committee, I do not need to move the bill for you. You can do that yourself.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1956.
Okay, House File 1956 is before the committee. Our intent is to lay this over. But to your bill, Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1956 would change the municipal liquor store threshold from $350,000 to $500,000 for being required to submit an audited financial statement to the state auditor. And by way of a little background, doing some research, this figure of $350,000 was set back in the early to mid-1990s. And if we adjusted that for inflation, today that number would be, I think, well north of $650,000. So I think the bill here at $500,000 is a cautious and acceptable adjustment to that figure if we take into account inflation. Mr. Chair, I was looking through the some audit reports last night. Didn't help me get to sleep, but it was interesting reading some of these state auditor reports. And a statement kind of caught my eye. And this is from the audit report from Auditor Blaha. It said, for many communities in greater Minnesota, municipal liquor operations provide access and convenience in areas that might not have the volume of customers to attract a privately run operation. In many of our smaller towns in greater Minnesota, it's a place where they have their weekly meat raffle or their Lenten fish fries beginning now this time of the year. It's just a place to gather. It might be the only place in town, and we want to try to help these operations stay going. But looking at the numbers, you know, combined profits of all operations in the state, this is from 2022, decreased by 26% from the previous year. And over the past 5 years, their net profits have been down by 6%. I have a testifier, Mr. Chair. He is a mayor of one of these towns that have a municipal liquor store. It's in the city of DeGraff, which is in western Minnesota, in Swift County, on Highway 12, just west of Benson. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to, if technology works, hear from our testifier this morning.
We will bring Mayor Simmons online. Mr. Mayor, if you would, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Technology is not our friend this morning.
Mr. Chair, I could give more statistics as we wait, but let's see.
Well,
if we can...
I'll just say, Representative Anderson, as a fan of the meat raffle, if you've never participated in a meat raffle, it is a good time. You should go. And I don't know if everybody has, but it's a good time. And meeting places like that are valuable to the community.
I might add, Mr. Chair, as we're waiting and hopefully get hooked up here, in that latest report that I saw, 142 liquor stores showed the decreased profits, and 27 of those, or a great majority, were from greater Minnesota. And so there is a squeeze on some of our rural areas as they try to keep their municipal stores open. And we're talking both on and off sale, Mr. Chair. So I would certainly hope the mayor could get hooked up with us. He's been waiting since before 8 o'clock this morning to
okay.
be with us.
Are we ready? Or are we still waiting for the technology to cooperate? Okay, so perhaps in the interest of committee time, Mr. Chair, we will, we're going to lay your bill on the table and then apologize to the mayor, but when technology becomes our friend again, we will take your bill off the table and proceed to finish that out if I have no objections from anybody. Seeing none, we will lay your, well, hang on. Okay, we're going to lay your bill on the table briefly, Representative Anderson. We're going to move on then to Representative McDonald. There we are. And since Representative McDonald is not a member of the committee, I will move House File 1025 to be before the committee. Representative McDonald, please proceed.
Yes, good morning, members. Mr. Chair, thanks for giving me a hearing. I was going to bring treats for you all, and I'm not a freshman. I've been here too long. But it seems like I'm a freshman because I haven't had a bill in over 2 years. But the Byerly's doesn't open until 10, and I didn't want to be late, Mr. Chair. So I'll bring treats another time for you all.
We appreciate your promptness.
Yes. So anyway, my bill, as you're probably aware, you have the bill in front of you and probably some talking points as well, just states that the Minnesota will acknowledge the great old flag of the state of Minnesota as a historic flag and allow our civic leaders, our states, our counties, our cities, the ability to fly it below the current flag if they wish, or just fly it as well in addition to. And it just makes sure that it's historic. You know, our Minnesota flag, although some may think it's controversial, it has a lot of great history. In 1983, in chapter 119, section 1, my father was here at the legislature, K.J. McDonald, and he voted at that time to make sure that it remained part of the Minnesota flag. So I'm kind of proud to carry on a little tradition of the work that he did and many others on both sides of the aisles when he was here back in 1983 during the session. So I, hesitant, I say it's a simple bill, but it certainly will preserve the flag of the state of Minnesota and the great history that it pertains. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have historian representative Bjorn Olson, who is also one of the authors and my testifier and co-author.
And before we proceed to Representative Olson, for brand new members, it is never advisable to say this is a simple bill.
Yes, I forgot.
Because they almost never are. But Representative Olson, welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am and others in the bill. I'm the one of the co-authors and others. One thing, I was having a conversation with the executive director of the Historical Society the other day, and we agreed that history is an important thing, that we need to run a fine line and not run to the left or right politically. So, you know, we can't forget about history. We can't just say it never happened, and we also can't dissolve it or throw it away. And that's what this bill is attempting to do. You know, in the federal government, every single flag that the United States has ever flown officially is an official historic flag of the federal government. So 13 stars, 32, which many of you probably have never seen, or if you did see it, you didn't notice how many stars were on it. You could, if you wanted to, if you loved it when America only had 32 states and for some reason you wanted to fly that flag, you could fly that flag. It would be recognized as a historical flag of the United States. And I think that what we do with this bill would make it would show the respect that the old flag that we have, it would show the respect that it's due, while at the same time recognizing that there is a new flag. It's on Representative Freiberg's computer right there and on his lapel pin. And so I think that this is a way to kind of run a fine line with this issue, and I think it's a way that we can all kind of come to an agreement that this flag deserves respect, that flag deserves respect, and let's just move on with it.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Member questions. I have Representative Freiberg and then Representative Kosnick, and then we will try to get to a close because we still have some other bills and we need to get to Representative Anderson's bill that we've laid on the table Wait, there is an A1 amendment. Representative Freiberg, I believe that is yours.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Would
you like to move the amendment?
Yes, I will move the A1 amendment.
Okay, to your amendment.
Thank you, bill authors, for bringing this forward. I appreciate that. Just one comment kind of about what you said. You said the bill allows state officials to fly the flag. I think that's a bit of an understatement. It actually requires it on state holidays. It actually mandates two flags flying simultaneously, which I do think could be confusing. It does call the old flag the historic state flag, which is fine. I have no problem with it. It's definitely the historic state flag. But the bill does mandate the old flag be flown on buildings in the present, which is kind of at odds, I think, with the historic designation. I did a little research. I saw the bill is modeled almost verbatim after a bill from Utah, which also changed its state flag recently. And I actually know one of the legislators from Utah who championed the new state flag there. So I texted him. There's a small group of legislators who've worked on state flags. We're a tight-knit group. And both parties, I should add. It's a bipartisan group. But the Utah legislator I spoke with said the law that this one's modeled after hasn't been followed because the governor issued an executive order there, partly to deal with the administrative burden of the law. I have seen the new flag flying more and more frequently, but I do see the old flag flying in some people's yards as well, and I think that's fine. I'd never try to tell people what to fly in their yards, certainly. But I will note that the old flag does have problematic imagery in its depiction of indigenous Minnesotans that's still present. I mean, I could read a poem written by the designers of the old state seal, which appears on the old state flag, which is pretty explicit that the designers of the old state seal wanted indigenous Minnesotans to leave the state permanently. I did read that on the floor when we discussed this in the last session, so I'll spare you at the moment. But I do think that makes it somewhat inappropriate to be flown on state buildings. So the amendment before us retains the designation of the old state flag as the historic state flag. It protects the ability of citizens to fly the old flag if they choose to, but it removes the requirement that the old flag be flown regularly on state buildings. And if the amendment went on, I'd certainly have no problem supporting the bill.
Representative McDonald, how would you like to proceed with the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg, that would kind of defeat the purpose of the history of our flag and allowing our civic leaders, our state, our counties, our cities, the ability to be able to fly it and to honor it as well. There's a history component to it as well. And since I have to my left a great history scholar, I will defer to him. He has some input as well, Representative Freiberg.
Representative Olson, and I'll remind us, we have a few more bills to get to, and we alacrity is the word of the day.
Alacrity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would look at the question for this amendment is, if it removes it from all state buildings, then does that include the Historical Society, which is a state building, and then it would revert this flag to the Virginia flag that we have hiding in a cupboard in the Historical Society that is not able to be flown because it is an offensive flag, and I think we can all agree that that flag may in fact be offensive, but it would akin this flag to the same, it would regard it as the same way. So if that amendment will not in fact prevent the Historical Society from showing that flag to the masses, then that's a different story. But the way I was reading that amendment, it would remove it from the Historical Society. It would akin it to the Virginia flag that we've got in the Historical Society's little cupboard, and we would shutter this away and forget that it ever happened. And then we're removing history, we're erasing history, and we're pretending that a part of our history as Minnesotans doesn't exist.
Representative Freiberg, briefly to close or nothing?
The bill contemplates the bill being old flag being flown along with the other one. If there were some tweaks, I mean, the bill is being laid over. If there were some tweaks to the language, and I'll have some, you know, on closing to the bill, not to the amendment, I'll have some questions about that as well. But if there were some tweaks to the language to distinguish between being flown and placed, you know, on display in the Historical Society, I'd certainly be fine with that. But I think in no way does this equate the old state flag with the Virginia flag that you mentioned. I've seen that one as well. It actually, you know, with the amendment, it designates this as the historic state flag, and it respects the right of citizens to use and display the state flag, so which we certainly don't have for the Virginia flag that you mentioned.
Okay. So the author of the underlying bill has requested a no vote, but Representative Freiberg has moved the A1. All in favor of the A1?
Aye.
Those opposed? Nay. The amendment is not adopted. Representative McDonald to... Representative Koznick.
Well, I was just going to say to my good friend, Representative McDonald, there is no simple bill. You are correct, but treats certainly help make things more simple and joyful for the committee. And as we see, no bill is simple.
Okay, Representative Freiberg, comment before
yeah,
we
one
close?
One question, then a brief comment. So thank you, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Proceed.
Sure. So just to the bill author, the bill designates the lieutenant governor as the person who will establish standards and specifications for the manufacture and display of the historic state flag. I'm just curious why you chose the lieutenant governor.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg, the governor has duties that are regularly very busy, and the lieutenant governor probably, I would imagine, and not this particular lieutenant governor, this could be going forward, could take 2 years for the bill to root if it doesn't pass this year, has an opportunity that gives them the opportunity to display the flag and, do something, I guess.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I mean, I saw the lieutenant governor was the entity responsible in the Utah bill that I mentioned. That might be appropriate in Utah, but it doesn't seem consistent to me with the lieutenant governor's other duties in Minnesota. If you were open to suggestions, I'd actually suggest that be changed to the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State is actually designated in statute as the custodian of the state seal, which seems like a similar duty to establishing standards for the historic flag. The bill is being laid over, so I'm hopeful that, if this moves forward, that type of thing could be looked at.
Representative McDonald, any comment?
Yes, Representative Freiberg, he and I serve on the Elections Committee, and I find a lot of your comments and your work that you do to be valid, and I think that's a very good point. This bill is going to be laid over, and I think I like the opportunity of turning it over from the Lieutenant Governor to the Secretary of State. That makes perfect sense. I am amiable to that. In addition to working with you as well, that we establish this as a historic flag, ultimately it would be nice to have this passed because we do need 68 votes to pass. And it'd be great to have members on both sides of the aisles to support this. When I went around getting signatures 2 weeks ago, excitingly, I was on both sides of the aisles, and I had very good comments from my friends on the Democrat side, particularly Representative Lilly and several others. But they're open to getting this passed as well with some tweaking of language. So I look forward to working with everyone.
Very good. Okay, Lee Cleburne, are you going to close or anything to add?
Just, I would ask that you please consider the Freiberg Amendment. I think it makes it, if it comes up later on the floor or someplace, or to incorporate it while you work on the bill, it would make it so much easier for us to be able to give you a yes vote and to declare this the official historic flag. Thank you.
Representative McDonald, to close.
To close, Mr. Chair, thank you for the hearing, and Representative Claiborne and Representative Freiberg, yes, I am very open to that. There's some great suggestions there, and we'll work on that going forward sincerely. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative McDonald, and as many of you know, I, as a hobby, make flags out of reclaimed barnwood that fly around the Capitol, and I have made a 32-star flag, I have made a 48-star flag, and I think that the value of historic flags are quite significant as to where in either our nation's or our state's history that point in time was. But encourage you to continue working on this. And with that, House File 1025 is laid over. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Back to, okay. So chair is going to take House File 1956 off the table. And Representative Anderson, we will go to your testifier, no?
Mr. Chair, no, it didn't work, and he had to get to another meeting, too, but I did visit with him, and the highlight of his testimony, if I could proceed, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Okay. DeGraff is a town of 110 people in Swift County, and in 2012, their audit cost them $12,000, and for next year, their proposal is $18,500. And according to my math, that's an increase of 54%, and it just is becoming cost prohibitive. So he was strongly in favor of the bill, Mr. Chair, and I would encourage support for it. And and the bill is going to be laid over, so thank you again for your support.
Very good. Members, questions to House File 1956? Representative Bonner, very briefly, we're trying to beat the clock.
Very briefly. I will just say, Representative Anderson, I appreciate this bill. I grew up in Richfield and Bloomington, and I know they do have municipal liquor stores, and I appreciate that this limit has not been changed in some time. So in the spirit of good government, I actually appreciate this bill, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Okay. Lead Cleavorn has a joke of the day.
So, you know, I voted against the grain elevators.
Yes, right. I know. Yeah.
But I'm happy. But I'm happy to go along with this one. That's all.
Lead Cleavorn is trying to go 50-50 propositions with you, Chair Anderson. To your bill, Representative Anderson.
Well, thanks again, Mr. Chair. This kind of makes my day, helping the small towns, and appreciate the support. And thanks, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Anderson, thank you for your effort here. And House File 1956 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next, we will move on to House File 791. Representative Myers is here. I don't see treats. That could be a tragic.
I brought donuts last time.
I don't remember getting any treats. Okay, I don't eat donuts, but since Representative Myers is not a member of the committee, Chair moves House File 791 to come before the committee. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 791 is a bill designating Castoroides ohioensis as the state fossil, which is AKA the giant beaver. This is a bipartisan effort, so I do want to thank co-authors on this, which are Representative Cagle, Olson, and McDonald, and there is an A1 amendment.
Very well. The A1, Chair will move the A1 to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this amendment does is also provides the name both in Dakota as well as Ojibwe.
Members, conversation to the A1? Seeing none, all in favor? Aye. Opposed? Okay. Representative Myers, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. I'm going to let the testifier do most of the talking, but Minnesota is, you know, one of only a handful of states that does not have a state fossil, and my testifier kind of take away from there of why this one has been chosen.
Thank you.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Alex Hastings, the Fitzpatrick Chair of Paleontology at the Science Museum of Minnesota. I see state symbols as a wonderful educational opportunity where we can introduce new things to our kids as they're growing up through the school system in particular, as well as everyone else in the state. And for that reason, we would love to bring forward a state fossil. We are one of four states that does not have one, and we'd like to fix that. We carried a vote a couple of years ago in order to make a decision on what that fossil should be. We got more than 11,000 people to weigh in on what that should be. Great representation across the state, and there was a very, very clear winner. It was none other than the giant beaver here, Castoroides. It is a fantastic choice as a resident of Minnesota here during the last ice age, dying out just a bit over 10,000 years ago. One of the fascinating things about this animal, not only is it a 200-pound rodent, the largest rodent ever in North America, it also would have existed with the first people settling into Minnesota. There's even some folklore that suggests of those personal interactions, which is fantastic, which has also led to it getting very nice support from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and that's also how we came to translations in Dakota and Ojibwe. As far as I'm aware, this is the only state that would have indigenous translations included in a bill for a state fossil, which would also be very cool, especially when we're 47th in line to do it. And it is currently on exhibit at the Science Museum. We have a skeleton there that was found just under 7 miles from where we're all sitting, right in St. Paul. We have another skeleton that I'm showing right here from Minneapolis, and it's well represented across particularly the central and southern parts of the state. It is an amazing and very cool creature. No other state has anything like this, and I think this could really set the bar for Minnesota with a really cool thing that we can all be behind, and everyone gets to learn about the amazing fossil record of Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony. We will move to member questions. Anybody? Very well. Okay. Representative Myers, am I correct that you've got folks watching from some remote location?
Yes, I think this bill initially came to me from a middle school class, but I believe there's also Representative McDonald's, one of his middle school classes is actually watching.
Okay, very well. Member questions once, twice. Lead Cleburne, any conclusion? Okay, Representative Myers, with that, House File 791 is laid over.
Thank you.
Oh, as Chair will make a correction. Thank you, Amanda. House File 791 as amended is laid over. So I'll bang the gavel another time for good measure. All right. Representative Myers has another bill. And again, since you're not a member of the committee, House File 1171, I will move 1172 to come before the committee. Representative Myers, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1172 is designating Ursa Minor as the state constellation. Kind of have a theme here. You know, Minnesota has a state bird, a state flower, a state tree, a state fish, a state dance, and even a state beverage. This is a bipartisan bill. The purpose is, you know, using Ursa Minor because it has the North Star in it. And, you know, the North Star means a lot to us. I've heard many a stories from the chair about the North Star and other committees. So, you know, Ursa Minor's been a marker for travelers and explorers for thousands of years. Designated as a state constellation, honors the cultural heritage of both Minnesota's indigenous people and state's history for exploration and settlement. The symbolic designation can be a point of pride for residents and contributors to a deep sense of state pride, and similar to state symbols such as state bird, tree, and hopefully the fossil. You know, I would just ask members to, you know, consider this and support this as our state constellation.
Okay, member questions. Representative Bonner, do you have a question? Okay, you gave me a look that maybe you did. Anybody else? Lead Cleburne.
Thank you, Representative Myers, for bringing the bill forward. I'm just curious, did you have conversations with MIAC since you referenced the tribes?
Representative Myers.
Thank you. Yes, through the Science Museum, we had a little bit of conversations, but we're still having those potentially for a similar amendment like the last bill.
Okay. Lee Cleburne.
Thank you. I would just request that if we move something like this forward, that we make sure that we have some acknowledgement from the tribal community that they are in agreement, especially if we're claiming it as one of their sacred pieces. So thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Representative Myers, any comment to that?
No, I just appreciate you guys hearing this bill. I think, again, it's got a lot for everybody. It's something that, you know, is very easily seen in those dark nights, especially as you get up to northern Minnesota. But I just thank the committee here for hearing it.
Okay. We appreciate your time here today. With that, House File 1172 is laid over. Members, that concludes our work for the day. Thank you for your time here today. With that, we are adjourned.